Kim with the first official episode of How to Get Away with Law, an unofficial podcast for the hit TV show How to Get Away with Murder, starring Viola Davis. Before I get into the episode review, I want to let everybody know that this is going to be a spoiler-free podcast at this point. Considering we are at the hiatus in this first season here, I'm recording this on January 2nd, 2015, and I'm going to be going back and reviewing the former episodes. I will not have any spoilers in it, since at this point in time I do have a good idea of what the plot is at this point, but don't worry, I will not be spoiling it for anyone, just in case they come by this podcast later, or now, or whenever. But without further ado, I will get into the pilot synopsis. We start out at a bonfire in full swing at Middleton University. Four students are in the woods discussing how to get rid of the murder weapon, the scales of justice. They continue on to argue about how to get rid of a body. One student suggests deciding via coin flip. Heads, get the body. Tails, leave it where it is. And then the coin is flipped. We flash back to 3 months earlier. A student is on his bike heading to class. As he heads to class, we close in on a Have You Seen Me poster with the face of Lila Stangard, who was last seen on August 20th, 2014. The student enters the classroom amidst discussion of the legendary professor, Annalise Keating. Each year, four students are chosen as the prospects that will work to get a spot at Professor Keating's law firm. As he takes a seat and begins to talk to a female student, she quickly dismisses him and tells him that there is a seating chart. Professor Keating enters the classroom and begins to introduce the students to the premise of the course. They begin to discuss the case of Mr. Kaufman, who went into anaphylactic shock after an attempted murder, which is expounded upon by Michaela Pratt, the student that rebuffed Wesley Givens, our main character thus far. Professor Keating calls on Wes to answer a question which he is unprepared for. The assignment was emailed to the students prior to the class, but Wes states that he was on a waiting list and was accepted 2 days before the class started. Professor Keating proceeds to answer the question and asks what was Mr. Gina Sadowski's guilty state of mind while committing the intentional murder known as the mens rea. As Wes fumbles, another student pipes up with the answer, to kill Mr. Kaufman. Laurel Castillo gives the answer and is immediately reprimanded for stealing another student's moment of education. Another student, Connor Walsh, asks if Ms. Sadowski was guilty. Professor Keating admits that it is a current case and the students can ask Ms. Sadowski themselves. We cut to the students interviewing Ms. Sadowski as a class. She admits that she loved Mr. Kaufman, and the day the attempted murder happened was her last day working for him, and she came to the office to see the paramedics on the scene. She claims she'd never want to hurt him. Professor Keating challenges the students to find the best defense that they would have to present in class within the time span of a minute. No defense can be presented twice. The winner gets the Scale of Justice statue, which will get the awarded student out of any exam. In this scene, we are also introduced to two people who work for Professor Keating, Bonnie and Frank. We also gain a little screen time with another central character, Asher Millstone. We move to Wes practicing his defense in his department, and he feels Gina is guilty. He is interrupted by a neighbor listening to loud music. Wes knocks on his neighbor's door. A young woman with no regard for law students and their study time answers the door and dismisses him. Wes goes back to his apartment and discovers scratch marks on the wall above his bed. We move forward to 3 months later, and the four students are rolling an object up in a carpet in Professor Keating's house. Laurel washes the scales of justice, which had been covered in blood. Michaela is reluctant to help them move the body that is now rolled up in the carpet, but finally agrees to help. As they are going outside with the carpet, a cop asks them if one of them owns the car that is blocking the pathway for other cars to pass through. The cop asks if this is the house of the famous lawyer. Michaela and Laurel try to concoct a story to stop the cop from questioning them about Annalise Keating's whereabouts. Michaela claims that Professor Keating is at her mother's funeral and she would hate to have to call her. The cop leaves them be. We go back to 3 months earlier and the students are presenting their minute defenses. As each student presents, Wes is forced to mark off a lot of his defense ideas. Wes presents last and says that they should say it was self-defense and that Ms. Sadowski was suffering from Stockholm Syndrome. Her poisoning him would be an act of self-defense. The other students laugh, but Professor Keating says no one beat her approach, which was to discredit the witness, introduce a new spec, who would be Lionel Bryant, then bury the evidence. This would cause the jury to doubt and would help them to get away with murder. The next day, the case is being presented in court. Michaela shows up late and whispers something to Frank. Professor Keating asks to halt briefly and confronts Michaela, who whispers into her ear. Professor Keating begins to question the witness and asks her if it was true that she saw the pill Mr. Kaufman took was yellow, similar to the color of Prosecutor Williams' shirt, but his shirt is blue. The witness says yes, and Annalise points out that his shirt is blue, not yellow. She is forced to reveal she is colorblind, which is what Michaela discovered, and this discredits the witness. Michaela is not yet guaranteed the statue until the other students step up their game. In her room, Wes's neighbor sees a news piece of Lila Stangard. She flops onto her bed, her expression unreadable. Later, Wes is in his room looking through copious amounts of documents about the Kaufman case. He discovers something and goes to Professor Keating's house. She does not answer her door, and the door is open. He enters and finds Keating in her office having sex with a mysterious black man. He tells Wes to get out. Keating stops Wes and calls Frank to tell him that he did not lock up. Again. She hangs up and tells Wes to tell her what he came for. Wes says he came across a case, Commonwealth v. McGinnis, which says they can move to a faster verdict if they think the prosecution's evidence is insufficient. Keating says what he is suggesting is called a directed verdict, and if they ask for it and get denied, all the public would perceive that there is enough evidence to convict. Wes says that Keating discredited the first assistant in court, and Keating says his idea was a bad one. She tells him goodnight, calling him the wrong name, but Keating doesn't seem to care. We flash forward to 3 months later again, and the students are in the car with the body. Connor is singing a Christmas carol. Wes gets back into the car with a bag from a convenience store and throws it at Laurel. She asks what it is, and Wes says he decided to buy other things, just in case he was on the surveillance video in the store. We do not get to see what is in the bag. Back 3 months ago, Connor is in a bar flirting with an IT guy from the company that Ms. Sadowski worked for. He pumps him for information. The next day in court, Connor presents Professor Keating with the information he has given. When Keating asks how he got the information, he declines telling her that he seduced the IT guy into bed to get it. She doesn't push the issue and says they will just have to get creative with making up a reason they could have gained the information legally. As we glance upon Mr. Kaufman, disabled in a chair, we see his wife sitting next to him looking distraught. Keating is questioning Mr. Bryant. She asks him about a meeting with Kaufman involving moving Gina Sadowski to accounting the day he was poisoned so that they can avoid a sexual harassment lawsuit. She asks Mr. Bryant to read the email he sent to Kaufman in regard to the situation, which is the information Connor deduced out of the IT guy. The email is a request for Kaufman to step down as CEO because of another affair with an employee. Immediately, the email is called into question because it was not part of the discovery file. Annalise allows Bonnie to explain that she supposedly found the email in the file given by their client's previous attorney, and she assumed it was part of the discovery file. The judge takes this into account and considers it to be acceptable. Connor refuses to tell the students how he got the email. We cut to a scene outside of the courtroom during a break. Ms. Kaufman is trying to go to the ladies' room, but Mr. Kaufman is begging her not to go. Ms. Kaufman sees Ms. Sadowski going into the ladies' room and follows suit. Laurel happens to be in the bathroom and sneaks into a stall to spy on the women. As Gina is touching up her makeup, Ms. Kaufman puts a comforting hand on her shoulder. Gina leaves, but Laurel sees the exchange. Later, Wes is walking his bike up the stairs to his apartment when he hears a woman yelling. He sees a young man leaving his female neighbor's apartment angrily and in a hurry. He sees his neighbor seated on the floor looking distraught. He asks if she needs help, and she tells him to get out of her apartment. Wes leaves to go to a party where he meets up with Connor, Asher, and Michaela, who are talking to a psychology professor named Sam that teaches at the university. He is lecturing the students about handling their first year working with Professor Keating. He says he works with the firm sometimes. Wes asks who his wife is, and he admits that he is married to Professor Annalise Keating. Annalise approaches, and she and Wes exchange a look that communicates that the man Wes caught her with was not her husband, and that he should keep that detail to himself. Back to the night of the bonfire, Michaela, Connor, Laurel, and Wes are in the woods carrying the body in the rug. They hear a couple making out in the woods and hide behind a tree. Laurel's phone rings. It is Frank. The couple asks who's there and takes off. Michaela sees the caller ID and asks why Frank is calling her. We flash back to a scene between Laurel and Frank discussing the exchange she saw between Gina and Ms. Kaufman. Laurel realizes that Frank knew the information and knew that Gina was guilty. Frank rudely teases her about being one of the young women who comes to law school with dreams of defending the less fortunate, only to end up working a corporate job and quitting after getting pregnant. Laurel calls him misogynistic and leaves. Bonnie hears the whole exchange and tells Frank to stop screwing the students. Wes meets with Annalise at the party and says she needs to apologize. She tells him that her husband and she have been trying to have a baby for a long time and it is putting a lot of pressure on their marriage. She begins to cry and says she is only making it worse and asks for forgiveness. She begins to rub his chest, almost seductively. Wes does not answer, but leaves crying, a crying Annalise behind. Later, Frank and Bonnie are in the office and sees Griffin O'Reilly, the Middleton University quarterback, on the news, hosting a vigil for Lila Sandgaard, who is still missing. He was Lila's boyfriend. Sam enters the room and kisses Annalise, their exchange rather suggestive, making Bonnie uncomfortable. Wes is back in his apartment, examining the scratch marks above his bed when he hears a sound outside. He opens the door and sees a bottle of wine on his doorstep. He sees Rebecca, his neighbor, opening her apartment door, and she explains that she works at a bar and left the bottle as an apology. Wes asks if they should open the bottle together since he had a rough day. She says she can't and heads into her apartment. The next day, they are back in court. A witness, Detective Gill, is on the stand and is being asked what videotape footage that is being asked about video footage that is being played from a store. The night before the murder, Ms. Sadowski was seen buying a brand of aspirin. We cut to a scene where Annalise is yelling at Ms. Sadowski for failing to alert them of this detail. She kicks her out after. Bonnie and Frank were in the room at the time, and they argue over the missed detail. Next, we see Annalise call up their first witness in court, a detective, Nate Leahy, who asks what the hell is the situation he is being put in. He is the man Wes saw Annalise having sex with. Wes looks appalled and upset. Annalise asks him where he was 2 nights ago when Detective Gill acquired the video that incriminates her client. He was supposed to be working at his precinct as his direct supervisor. Nate says he was supposed to be there and is asked by Annalise if he was there that night. He said he was not, and she asks him where he was at home, taking care of his wife, maybe, who had been recently diagnosed with cancer. Nate says he was at a friend's, and Annalise said she only asked because she found the chain of custody of the video strange. Gill said he received it from the store owner at 8 p.m., but the log shows it was logged into custody at 2:09 a.m., and the time gap was odd. Nate says that it sometimes takes a while to log evidence. Wes continues to grow more alarmed. Annalise asks if Nate's 12 years of working for the city of Philadelphia, if he has known about surveillance video being digitally altered to help the prosecution get a conviction. The judge allows the question. Nate says he does know of footage being edited within his division. Ms. Sadowski is found not guilty, and Annalise gives a statement at the end of the case stating that Ms. Sadowski has always been innocent. The students are awed. Michaela states that she wants to be Annalise. They are now under her spell. In class, Annalise awards the statue to Connor Walsh and chooses him as a prospect to work at her firm. She also picks Asher Millstone, Michaela Pratt, Laurel Castillo, and since the firm has grown, she elects to pick one more student, who turns out to be Wes Gibbons. After class, Wes runs to catch up with Annalise. She admits that Nate is her boyfriend. Wes says he does not want the job if she picked him because of his knowledge of her affair with Nate and getting him to lie on the stand. Annalise says she picked him because he thinks well on his feet, and that if Wes thinks he is not suitable to the job, then he didn't have to take it. Wes begins to protest and says that it is not what he said, but Annalise tells him that it is exactly what he was saying right before he accused her of illegal acts to win the case. She says they won because she did her job. She tells him he can choose a less fulfilling job course or he could work with her. We do not get to hear his response. At a sorority house on campus, Kappa Kappa Theta, a maintenance man knocks on the door and a sorority sister answers. He says he got called about a low water pressure issue. She asks if anyone there called maintenance. The maintenance man goes upstairs to check the water tank. As he shines his flashlight down into the tank, he finds a dead woman's body. On the news, it is reported that the body was Lila Stangard's. Rebecca and Griffin are fighting in Rebecca's apartment when the newscast comes on and learns of Lila's demise. As the cast continues, we see Sam Keating drinking and watching the news. Annalise walks in and asks what happened. Sam says Lila, the student, was found in the water tank. Annalise says she is sorry. Sam dismisses it and feels sympathy for her parents. Annalise says she bets Griffin did it. Sam says they guess they will see. We flash forward to the four students unrolling the carpet in order to set the body on fire. We find out that Wes bought fuel to burn the body. Wes says it is the last chance. They all agree on burning the body or choose another option. They all agree to do it. As Wes lights the match, the glow of the fire reveals that the body they are burning is that of Sam Keating. Okay, and I'm just going to have to go ahead and admit, well, a few minutes into this episode, I was already hooked on this show. But by the end of this episode, I just knew I was going to be hooked on this show. And recently, I hadn't watched very much of Shonda Rhimes' TV shows. I mean, Grey's Anatomy seemed like it would be good, but I was just thinking I was tired of these doctor romances. Didn't bother with that. And Heard Scandal was good, but I never picked up on that. Wasn't much into the political dramas when it first started out. And I actually didn't even know about How to Get Away with Murder until about, it was two or three episodes in, and somebody at work asked me if I had ever seen the show. And I said I'd check it out, and I'm very glad I did. It's a great show. I, by now, of course, know a good portion of the story, but I'll have to admit, when I was first watching this, I was trying to put together, how in the world did these students end up here? I mean, how is it that they are burying Annalise's husband? How did they get to this point? Where is Annalise at this time? Because it doesn't look like she's in any of those scenes. And of course, when they're carrying the body out of her house and the cop stops them, they have to make up a story about where Annalise is. So that leads me to believe Annalise isn't in the house when this happens. And I'm trying to make the connections. What in the world could possibly have gotten them in this situation? The only thing that I know of at this point is that there had to be some sort of drama between Nate and her after this affair and Wes finding out about it. But at this point, I don't see anything about Sam even knowing about this affair, nor do I even know if he knows Nate. And I find that Annalise is not only is she a strong woman, but this is one of those, I mean, she thinks quickly on her feet. And of course, you know, if we are law-abiding citizens, we should all be upset at all the things that she seems to be doing to win her case don't seem very legal. They don't seem right at all. And at the end, when she talks to Wes and he accuses her of discrediting witnesses and getting Nate to lie on the stand, at this point, it's I'm wondering how she does this and how she's been able to lure students in to help her out with these things. Well, I guess we'll find on that out, but this was a great start to a great show, and it only gets better. So if you're listening to this and you have not seen all of the episodes, trust me, you want to keep with it. It is really good, and I like the dynamic of going back and forth with the flash forwards to the 3 months before when they are trying to get rid of the evidence and burn the body to figuring out how the story goes. Wes seems to be the main character that we focus on. We get a lot of his view of things, and of course he seems to already have a relationship with Annalise because of him walking in on the affair. There was a lot of speculation immediately when I was watching this, especially between not even just me and my coworkers, but others saying that, they wonder, maybe, just maybe, Wes is Annalise's son. That I'm not sure about, but, it would be pretty darn interesting if that turns out to be the case. But then again, Sam and Annalise, or at least Annalise, says that her and Sam have been trying to have a baby for a long time and obviously haven't been successful. This is what she tells Wes. But what if maybe Wes is her son, maybe from an affair? Who knows? But how in the world the guy is obviously not in his teens. I mean, he's going to law school. So how in the world would he not know this by now? But I guess we won't be finding that out anytime soon, will we? But it's quite interesting, and one of the aspects of this podcast, one of the things that made me want to start with this podcast, let me start with a disclaimer. I am not currently a law student, though I plan to go into law, and I don't suggest that I know a lot about law or can give any legal advice or anything like that. This is all just for informational purposes and because I wanted to know, really, are they using some of these aspects of law and arguing cases are these points valid? What do these terms mean? And that's what I wanted to get into next. We have a couple of law terms here that I wanted to talk about, and then there's a case, the Commonwealth versus McGinnis case that Wes mentions about to get the directed verdict, and I will discuss that briefly after I get into the terms. Now, one of the terms that they went into that Laurel ends up answering when Wes should have answered, with all his bobbling there, was the mens rea, which is a legal phrase used to describe the mental state a person must have been in while committing a crime for it to be intentional. It can refer to a general intent to break the law or a specific premeditated plan to commit a particular offense. And, of course, in this we try to discover what Gina Sadowski's mens rea is, and I think it was pretty inventive that Wes tried to say Stockholm Syndrome, because that would be a pretty awesome defense. Now, the directed verdict means, in a jury trial, a directed verdict is an order from the presiding judge to the jury to return a particular verdict. Typically, the judge orders a directed verdict after finding that no reasonable jury could reach a decision to the contrary. And this is referenced again when Wes is talking about the Common v. McGinnis case. And I was going to go into a brief synopsis here on what that case was. And I found these notes dated October 4th, 1995 through December 8th, 1995. And this was Commonwealth versus Brendan McGinnis. It states, a criminal defendant who was sentenced after a plea of guilty to armed robbery to 20 years at the Massachusetts Correctional Institution at Concord was not entitled to a new trial on the ground that his plea was induced by an illegal sentence predicated on post-conviction events, where the record of the plea colloquy showed that the judge's statement after imposition of sentence of his present intention to revise and revoke the sentence in 2 years upon the defendant's good behavior was not part of the plea bargain or sentence. The indictment found and returned in the Superior Court Department on April 24, 1990. A motion to withdraw a guilty plea filed on June 28, 1994 was considered by Paul A. Chernoff. The Supreme Judicial Court on its own initiative transferred the case from the appeals court. The case was submitted on briefs. And Lynch J. says the defendant appeals from the denial of his motion to withdraw his guilty plea for armed robbery. We affirm the denial of his motion. On June 26, 1990, the defendant pleaded guilty to the charge of armed robbery. He was sentenced to 20 years at the Massachusetts Correctional Institution at Concord. And, of course, I wanted to see the case from the other side as well, so I started looking that up, and I have that information here of that, and this is dated February 6, 1995 through June 12, 1995. And this is Brendan McGinnis versus Commonwealth. And it says a criminal defendant seeking review pursuant to GLC 211 Section 3 of the trial judge's denial of the defendant's motion to revise and revoke his sentence did not demonstrate that the alleged errors could not be remedied under the ordinary review process. Civil action commenced in the Supreme Judicial Court for the County of Suffolk on June 15, 1994. The case was considered by Greeny J. The case was submitted on briefs. Lynch J. says, the petitioner, whom we shall call the defendant, appeals from a single justice order denying his petition pursuant to GLC 211 Section 3, 1992 edition. The defendant sought relief from an order of a Superior Court judge denying his motion to revise or revoke his criminal sentence pursuant to Mass. R. Crime P. page 29A, 378 Massachusetts 899 in 1979. We affirm the judgment of the single justice. On June 26, 1990, the defendant pleaded guilty to the charge of armed robbery. The judge accepted the defendant's guilty plea and sentenced him to 20 years at Massachusetts Correctional Institution at Concord. At sentencing, the judge said that he would consider a motion to revise and revoke when the defendant completed 2 years of his sentence. The judge stated, in essence, that after serving 2 years, the balance of the defendant's sentence would be suspended, and he would be placed on probation unless he had any trouble with serving his sentence. On August 23rd, 1990, defense counsel filed a timely motion to revise or revoke the sentence, which remained dormant for two years. The judge noted that the motion would be entertained after June 27th, 1992, when the defendant would have served 2 years, On June 29, 1992, the judge allowed the defendant's motion without a hearing and suspended the balance of his sentence. The Commonwealth moved for reconsideration, and the judge vacated the order, pending a hearing. After hearing that, while in prison, the defendant had been found guilty of several disciplinary offenses, including one inmate assault and three staff assaults, the judge allowed the motion for reconsideration and denied the defendant's motion to revise or revoke his sentence. The defendant then moved for reconsideration of the order, denying his motion to revise or revoke, claiming that, in ruling on the motion, the judge improperly considered testimony concerning his behavior while incarcerated. This motion was denied, and the defendant sent a notice of appeal from the denial of his motion to revise and revoke to the Superior Court. This notice was not accepted for filing. The court clerk informed the defendant that there was no right to appeal from the denial of motion to revise or revoke. The clerk of the appeals court also informed the defendant that Rule 29 did not provide for a right of appeal. Thereafter, the defendant filed a petition in the county court pursuant to GLC 211, Section 3, seeking relief from the denial of this motion to revise or revoke. The single justice denial of that petition is the subject matter of this appeal. And we'll move forward quickly on where we go. Let's see. The defendant contends that in ruling on his motion to revise his sentence, the judge improperly considered the defendant's conduct after the initial sentencing. The defendant argues that to consider events taking place after sentencing is a violation of Article 30 of the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights. The defendant properly raised the issues in his motion for leave to withdraw his guilty plea and for a new trial pursuant to Rule 30B. The denial of this motion is currently before the appeals court, and the issues will be afforded full appellate review. The defendant has failed to demonstrate that the alleged errors cannot be remedied under the ordinary review process. Therefore, the single justice was warranted in denying the petition to exercise the extraordinary power of GLC 211, Section 3. Judgment affirmed. And I know that was a lot of legal speak, but I just thought it was interesting to look into the case, because sometimes you hear about these cases on TV and you're just thinking, I'm not going to look that up. I just hope they're speaking the truth. But of course, I was curious to see what was going on. I thought it was a pretty interesting case, but I don't want to bore you with the details. And we're here to talk more about the show than we are to talk about all this other stuff. So hopefully that was a decent episode for the first one. I'm trying to get in the swing of things. I've done podcasting before. Podcast known as Ethnic Lesbian and Random, but this is the first time I'm podcasting about a TV show. I've been into podcasting and TV shows since Lost. I was actually one of the original Losties who got to listen to the Jay and Jack podcast as the show was going on. So I've been huge into podcasting, but I saw there weren't very many podcasts about How to Get Away with Murder, other than the amazing podcast that AfterBuzz puts out for it, so check that out. But I just wanted to put this out there, and as things go on, hopefully we'll get more fan interaction, if there indeed will be fans, and some feedback. Tell me what you think about the show. Tell me where you think it's going. Anytime, even if you aren't caught up yet, send me all of your email anyway, and tell me what you think the story is going to end up being, and who kills Sam, and how does this happen, and all that. So connect the pizzas and get back to me, and we'll discuss it in the next episode when we get to episode 2. And you can find me on Twitter at getawaywithlaw. There's a website, the howtogetawaywithlaw.blogspot.com website. You can find the page on Facebook at howtogetawaywithlaw. And email contact is howtogetawaywithlaw@gmail.com. So send some feedback and let's talk. And we will talk about this wonderful show. And welcome to the ride. It's a great one. This is Kim, signing out.